Hi, and welcome along to Early Excellence's Head to Head podcast. It's great to have you here. I'm Sarah Carey, School Improvement Lead here at Early Excellence, and in these podcasts, I'll be connecting with real head teachers and school leaders. We'll be discussing hot topics in primary and early years education and sharing some real experiences. So keep listening to hear more about school inspections and impactful school improvement strategies. Hello, hello. It is time for another Head to Head podcast. And today we're going to be digging into continuous provision beyond early years. So I'm really delighted today to be joined by Cassie Puplett, head teacher at Lingfield Primary School in Surrey. Hi, Cassie.
Morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I'm really delighted, and it's always a real privilege when heads can join and kind of spend a bit of time talking about things that they're passionate about, and I know you are, and you know, just sharing things that other heads and school leaders might be able to find useful in terms of their development journeys. So yeah, all good. Appreciate your time. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with you today. At Early Excellence, we talk a lot about continuous provision beyond early years, help lots of schools and settings, but it's a journey I think it would be fair to say that you've been on for quite a long time at your school. Yeah. And, you know, you've got quite a lot of experience and those sorts of things, which we'll dig into. But if we can, as always, if we can just start by hearing a little bit about you and your role, that always kind of sets the scene for us.
Thanks so much. So I've been head teacher at Lingfield for 5 years. Although I started here almost 20 years ago, okay, as early years lead, previously having worked in two other schools, advanced skills teacher in Croydon back in the day when we used to have advanced skills teachers.
Oh, yes. So,
yeah, loving going around, working with other settings when I was based in Croydon. Spent a year in a school in Kent, which was interesting because that was vertically grouped. So I had a year one, year two class then, mm-hmm. And then came to Lingfield many, many years ago, and was teacher in reception, two form entry school with a nursery, mm-hmm. And then progressed through my career, focusing predominantly on early years. Actually really have spent most of my teaching career in reception, dabbled a bit in nursery, dabbled a bit in year one and year two. Mm-hmm. Was really lucky to go to Reggio Emilia in 2009, which I think was quite career defining for me, I would say. Mm-hmm. Having read a lot about Reggio Emilia before, having done practice with Sightlines, UK-based stuff, it was great to be able to actually go. So took my then colleague and we went over to see the preschools in Italy for a week and came back and, you know, wowed and overwhelmed and all the rest of it, yeah, as I'm sure lots of people are when they go there. So in my role as early years lead, I then became a moderator for Surrey and a practitioner that would showcase some of the things we were doing here at Lingfield. We were one of the first schools in the framework before the old framework to get outstanding in early years, really, really long time ago as well. So that launched quite a lot of schools coming to see what we were doing then. And I think at that point, our key stage one provision was sort of just starting. It's had many iterations, which we will get onto. And it's now being brilliantly led by Charlotte Bunyan, who you will all know at Early Excellence because we partner with you. But I then moved into being assistant head. I then moved into being deputy head. And at that point, I did a lot more whole school curriculum work. And now I'm head. So always passionate about early years, will always be that voice for early years, championing it at every opportunity. So yeah, that's a bit about me.
Fantastic. And yeah, good to hear in terms of obviously you've done that wider school curriculum and you are kind of, you've visited Reggio, but I know you're well read, you're well researched, and you've had actually quite a range of experiences, I think it would be fair to say, yeah, that I think has probably helped to shape your kind of onward experiences, but kind of your drivers, what drives you in terms of what you're wanting to achieve for your children. So you've mentioned Reggio. So any other kind of experiences or opportunities or reading research that you've had been involved in that's kind of helped shape you and I suppose where your school is going in their trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. You know, we have always been evidence informed here. Mm-hmm. I think that's just gathered momentum over the last 10 years. I think like lots of settings, you know, we're an outward facing school. We read a lot. We blog now. We are on X/Twitter. And I think that we care a lot about selecting initiatives or practices or programs or ideas, reading really widely about them, making a good decision over time rather than a quick decision, and then investing everything we've got into that. You know, we will ensure high fidelity to what we choose. So that's really important. You know, Mary Mart's a big influence for us here. We're speaking to her later on today, which is quite nice, about early years, actually, and key stage one. So there could be an opportunity there for that to link, which would be fantastic, because we need to do less better. And I think being the head of a school, it's very easy to get distracted by all the shiny new things. And actually, one of the hardest tasks is to ignore a lot of that and stay really focused on what your school needs and the context of your school and what's going to make the best impact. Mm-hmm. So we cherry pick. We're a read, write, ink school. So we have been a read, write, ink school for around 10 years, I would say. Again, we still maintain our development days with that. So we ensure our practice is really strong. We use White Rose for teaching maths. And of course, we are an early excellence partnership school with you and have spent many, many years reading around Anna F. Graves' work, Alistair de Bryce Clegg, Jan de Beale, all the Education Endowment Foundation best practice. I think probably for most school leaders, the EEF was probably one of the most used platforms at the beginning and still now, where you could go to get lots of evidence-informed ideas and to shape and hone your practice. And now I think lots and lots of people are doing it, and the opportunities out there for being well-informed are actually quite overwhelming at times. I think there's loads of stuff out there. Mm-hmm. So it's about that being selective. And I think as a head, you've got to be really careful about that.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree, because it can be overwhelming. And I think one of the phrases that you said in kind of do less, but do what you're doing better. It's stripping the woods, stripping the white noise out, isn't it? And being able to see the woods for the trees. And that is quite difficult, because there's, you know, there's lots and lots happening in schools, lots of recommendations. But of course, what you're talking about is, yes, using an evidence-informed research, but getting reading around that and really researching it is really key. My colleague Phil often talks about being aware of the source, thinking about the kind of agenda behind that, but also thinking, what does that mean for my school, my children, my staff? How will that work? How will that look in the Lingfield way, if that makes sense?
I think that's really important here. And in fact, Phil came, he came to Lingfield and did our audit with us, and it was brilliant to spend the time with him. And when you read, the more you read, the more you can make links between things that are saying the same thing, but perhaps just someone's just decided to call it something else. Mm-hmm. That's important too, because that then makes you learn, oh, actually, it's just that again, or it's just that again. Mm-hmm. There isn't really many original ideas anymore, is there? I think we're still, jumping off the back of other great work that's happened previously and, you know, rethinking things potentially in terms of what we learn about how children learn and cognitive science and memory. That's, you know, true. But most of the best things we do in school, I don't think, are brand new.
Yeah, it's not about reinventing the wheel necessarily. No. It's about reinvigorating thinking and reflecting and kind of being constructive with yourselves. And actually, I know, again, we'll kind of mention it towards the end, but you actually wrote a blog quite recently, didn't you, kind of to that effect, about actually the closeness of early years in Key Stage 1 and actually Key Stage 2 and the pedagogical approaches.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I've enjoyed as a primary head teacher who's an early year specialist. I don't think there's many early years primary heads generally. I think, well, certainly a lot of colleagues I work with are Key Stage 2 based. And like I said, or even maybe Key Stage 1, maybe infant based, but, you know, most of my teaching experience has been in reception. I think you could spend a lifetime down in reception and nursery and do very well. But the more I read and the more I learn, and I'm really keen to learn around sectors. You know, we've got specialist provision here, which I'll talk about later, you know, and my deputy head, Anna, we're, you know, great friends, great colleagues, and she's a Key Stage 2 based teacher, spending most of her career in year 5 and 6. So, you know, we come together with very similar ideas and very similar ethos and pedagogy. And the more that we connect with people through Twitter, most of those people are secondary based. However, what I'm learning is that actually, you know, there's more across sectors that align than divide. And I think perhaps sometimes we can get quite stuck in thinking about what we do. And actually, being an early years teacher before, I used to be that big voice in leadership meetings and staff meetings. People probably would get quite annoyed with me being like, oh, but what about early years? Oh, but what about early? You know, I did that the whole time. So, you know, I've got someone else that does that now. And I get it, because you do have to be heard and you have to be understood, actually. I think it's more the understanding, and that's why you have to have a big voice. But I still hear and see that in terms of sector divides. And I'd really like to, you know, build bridges between those sectors, because, you know, great teaching and learning is not that different between a 3-year-old and a 13-year-old. And there's a lot of crossover between the characteristics of effective learning and things like Rosenshine's principles, which is something that we use that underpins everything we do at Lingfield. So, I'm enjoying finding the connections and joining the dots across sectors, actually. I'm really enjoying that, which I didn't realise would be quite a big part of my leadership journey as a head.
Yeah, no, great. And it's really interesting, isn't it? And I love the fact that several times, actually, in that little short piece, you kind of said, what I'm learning. And actually, every day is still a school day, isn't it? And I think it's important for leaders to continue to grow and kind of strengthen themselves. And again, that's sometimes hard to do because of the grind of the day to day and the pressures of the day to day and those sorts of things. So, no, really, really inspiring. So kind of on that note, I guess I'm sure this will be really clear for you, but one of the things that we talk about when we're supporting schools with developing provision into year one and beyond is really for schools, but particularly school leaders, to really kind of have a really clear vision and to kind of have some really clear expectations for learning and expectations for play. And I know for you and for your school, you've kind of really unpicked that, and it's a huge job, but actually having absolute clarity in that and a really shared understanding of that really helps to underpin kind of the onward journey of development. So can you share a little bit around your kind of expectations for play and kind of the learning and those sorts of things?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, the vision at Lingfield for everyone is to do their personal best. That's our vision statement. We're a personal best school. So it was nice for you to hear that nod to me continuing on my learning journey, because actually that's what everybody does here, whether you work here or attend here. We're all on that journey together. And I think it just centers around adults learning, not just the children. And I think that's my job to curate as the head teacher. Like I said before, we cherry pick from the best and we have high fidelity to the things that we choose. But also we have to recognise the developmental stages and what's required as children mature and grow and develop and understand how memory and learning works, and recognise that those environments that you provide within a school setting need to shift as the children get older. You know, so our nursery and reception provision would be very familiar to lots of people, because that's, I think, generally where play-based learning is considered allowed. There's permission for play with our 3- and 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds. But it feels all of a sudden that shifts and changes when they hit 5 and 6. And yet we know that, you know, we're one of the only countries that send their children to formal education so young. So we have to really learn about what works from the things we read and the things we know from education across the globe. And that's that children need to, you know, they need to be active and they need to be doing and they need to experience what they're being asked to learn through, I guess. They need to be able to interact with that. So for Lingfield, we have a hybrid. You know, in year one, it looks really similar to reception. The environment's the same. Access to outdoor learning is the same. Read, Write, Ink goes across, White Rose goes across. There are direct instruction sections, which I can talk about later. But fundamentally, the environment that the children experience will look so similar to the one they had in reception. And actually, when you then go into year two, the environment looks really, really similar again. But what we do is we spend a lot of time ensuring that the challenge and the rigor around what that environment offers is matching that developmental stage and that growth from the children as they are able to know more, do more. So interactions with the children obviously is number one. You know, we have to have really well-trained staff that know how to talk about learning with children, know the right questions to ask, know when watching is good enough. And observation is still so important. I think observation is really important when you're in year six. And as a reception teacher, I used to spend so much of my time observing children's learning, and I'd get so much from that. And that is still something that happens in Key Stage 2, and yet we call it assessment. But it's the same thing. You're just watching, right? And you're just noting down what you're seeing. And that impacts what you do the next day. And I think that's really important in Key Stage 1 and Key Stage 2. They just look a little bit different. Children need to be able to, you know, select resources and have some autonomy and some independence over what they're going to do. That doesn't mean to say that the adults aren't teaching. And I can talk about our structure of a day, if that's helpful for you. But I think it really, really matters that there's practice, opportunities for children to do things lots and lots of times to ensure that they really understand that foundational knowledge before they go on to the next stage of their education. And that's how we do that here at Lingfield. So our year one and our year two look very, very similar to our reception practice. Mm-hmm. The expectations just increase as the children get older.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? Because continuous provision is a pedagogical approach. And what you're talking about in terms of looking similar is the pedagogical approach. So you are expecting for those children to be able to access continuous provision. There will be elements of enhanced provision. You're expecting the adults to engage in kind of focused teaching, as well as following learning and those adult interactions and those standing back and those observations. And it's that pedagogical approach. But it's how it evolves over time, isn't it? It's so that your children don't leave early years and join year one and there's a kind of a cliff face that they fall off, or actually that happens at the end of the year one instead of the end of reception. But actually, while that pedagogical approach offers that continuity, the learning environment in terms of the resources and the equipment within that, there will be some continuity, but there will also be scope for progression within that. And there will also, I assume, well, I know there'll be that connection to the national curriculum and the expectations within that, not the UIFS. It's really, really key that the pedagogical approach is similar and the principles for that. But, you know, Key Stage 1 provision is not just a repeat of early years experiences.
No,
it's and that's, how it evolves and how it is. And that's often a stumbling block.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the joy of the challenge, because it's all about preparation. But again, mm-hmm. you know, that's with any good teacher. But you need to know what the children, you need to know what your end game is, what the outcomes are meant to be, and then work backwards from that. And, you know, the provision daily needs to be rigorous, and it needs to be underpinned by learning, not just because it's a nice thing to do. And I think that having staff that are well trained in that and understand when they are having exchanges and dialogue with children, what opportunities there are, that's what's brilliant about working in this way. There's no ceiling. And I think that's what our staff have really noticed in this process. Staff particularly who've moved out of Key Stage 2 to work in Key Stage 1, which is a joy in itself. If that, I've got lots of Key Stage 2 practitioners and teachers that actually would love to go into Key Stage 1, is that, you know, you're always wowed by, you know, what the children can tell you they and what they know. So, you know, the learning has got to evolve and match and develop alongside the needs of the children. And I think it really helps children who are very young still, who come into education, who are summer borns, who, you know, if we don't get the learning environment or climate right for those children, it's much more difficult to switch them back onto it when they hit Key Stage 2. Often they're a bit disaffected. And we don't see that here. We have children that go into Key Stage 2 with a thirst for knowledge and a love of learning. Because I think those subtle things that are very difficult to get right can easily go wrong if education is too formal too quickly. And we tell our parents that, you know, we've just finished all of our new reception tours for prospective parents. And I make it really clear that if they're going to choose Lingfield for their child, then they're going to see an early years model replicated in year one and year two. Their children will be learning inside and outside. You know, there's not enough desks for them to sit around for certain lessons. In fact, the adults move things around between phonics and independent provision, you know, and if they want formal education from year one, then we're not the school for them. And actually, so many parents afterwards have been like really grateful that I've explained it so bluntly, actually, and just said, we're really pleased because we were really worried, you know, that actually that, you know, once they get to the end of, you know, reception, that all of a sudden they're going to be in this environment when they're just talked at and they've got to sit still for hours on end. And, you know, that's just not what the body needs when you're 5 and 6. It's not the best way to learn.
No, I was just going to say, it's not conducive to learn. It's not as conducive for learning. The children will still learn, but it's much more difficult for them to engage in that, and it's much more difficult for the teachers to teach. So it's about helping the children to create a climate for learning that helps them to learn effectively and efficiently. And that's what you're talking about. And actually your strength of being able to be, if you like, as you said, so blunt with parents and carers is because you have absolute clarity in your vision and you know it works and it works for your children.
I think that's because we've got this blend. So our children have, you know, direct instruction through Read, Write, Ink, White Rose. Then they will have similar for foundation subjects, you know, inputs from the teacher. You know, we really have to be aware that children absolutely need direct instruction. Mm-hmm. We do that when we're teaching them how to put their coats on. We do that when we're teaching them how to brush their teeth. We do that in lots and lots of ways. And that is direct instruction, whatever anyone wants to call it. That's what it is, really. And then they need opportunities for guided practice, which is a Rosenstein sequence here. And that's when we do things together. You know, we're going to, you know, whether that's you, another practitioner, a more capable child, you know, we do things where we do things together. And then there's opportunities for independent practice, which is like, I'm going to apply this now because I know it really well. And so our philosophy is within our continuous provision, children should be revisiting things that they've been taught. Yes, there's resources around for, you know, free choice to expand or could, you know, extend on a concept or an idea or a theme that they've come across before. Yes, that is there. But predominantly, they are returning to practice on their own through a whole load of resources and loose parts, aspects of learning that the teacher has already taught. And that gives great assessment opportunity, great opportunities to support those that need extra tuition or extra teaching, and also to really fly with the ones that have grasped it. So that comes back to that ceiling I talked about before. You know, you just don't have that when you work in this way. You can steer the day according to what the children need. And that flexibility is excellent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, the learning environment is so crucial in that, because the children can only go away and practice and apply and explore and find out and have another go and make new connections and find out new things if the learning environment and crucially the resources enable them to do that. And there is a strong connection between the discrete, explicit, really high quality teach where staff have imparted knowledge, modelled information, explained things, given them new concepts, new knowledge, to then go away and practice and apply. And again, it's not just to go and have a go at it once, which is what happens in the more traditional ways. Often it's kind of, we've done this and then we all go and do this and then it's done and we move on. Actually, that practice and apply is important, but that opportunity to retrieve it and have another go at it, or retrieve it and take it in a different direction, and the open-ended kind of possibilities that the learning resources kind of provide for that is key. So you've talked a couple of times about this hybrid approach, because you've got some very kind of formal structured things within your kind of school day and within the kind of systems that you follow. So can you give a little bit more kind of insight into how a typical day maybe looks for a child in terms of that structure? Obviously, you've got phonics. Obviously, you've mentioned we don't have enough tables for everybody, and that's a thing. You know, we get asked that a lot, but what about phonics? And we talk around, actually, phonics is a part of your day, can be up to 45 minutes, maybe longer, but that shouldn't dictate the other 4 hours of your classroom use, if that makes sense. So tell us a little bit about the structure of the day or the experiences of your children, how that looks, how that feels.
So we are having, you know, worked with Read, Write, Ink for many, many, many years. Again, we've had so many iterations of the structure of a day and how to timetable a day to give as much contact with continuous provision as possible. So our children in year one don't go to assembly. They don't have break time because they have the opportunity to be outside so much of the time, and they're playing anyway. So it's just a bit of a nonsense. And we want I think actually our early years in Key Stage 1 will have the most curriculum contact than any other year group, actually, because of our timetabling. Yes, year 1 and 2 have PE. They do. That's something that gets added in, I suppose, as a discrete subject. But otherwise, you know, they don't stop for anything other than lunch. So we have as much contact with that as possible. So that would look like phonics in the morning, then continuous provision will. So I know that listeners will want to know, well, how do you move the classroom back around again? What do you do? And the reality is that they will have their numbots session of their math session, which will come later. So they'll do the numbots bit with all the numbons whilst the adults are moving the room around. Then they'll engage in independent provision, continuous provision. And they'll do that all the way up until they tidy up. And then they'll have their maths input, which is White Rose. And again, mm-hmm. you know, we work across the year group. Again, it's quite active. You know, it's not just, you know, sitting and talking at children for half an hour. You know, there'll be all the adults, a bit like Read, Write, Ink. We use all our adults to make sure that we're thinking about the needs of groups of children and what they need to practice and what they need to do to be challenged. And then they'll go to lunch. And then after lunch, they may have a input that's to do with their context for learning, which mm-hmm. is what we call our topics. So our contexts are driven by a geography, history or science focus across the whole school. So they'll have an input to do with that. And again, we use talking and thinking project books here. So that could start with like a thinking tub. So if you're doing a science context in your thinking tub, you will have lots of props and bits and pieces that link to your context, and they will be shared with the class, and the class will all ask questions or share reflections or observations or things they know about these items. And then that leads the discussion and the conversation for the project. That gets documented in a floor book. We're now just playing around with these floor books being electronic rather than actual big. They were big scrapbooks what the children were doing, but now they are electronic. So again, I guess that's different too for lots of schools. We don't, mm-hmm. the kids don't have loads and loads of books for things because we record everything on Tapestry that's useful, everything on Tapestry that links to the national curriculum, like you were saying before. So it hits one of those objectives. Or in early years, you know, we're looking at the early years framework and the development matters in early years. So our kids don't have lots and lots of books, and we don't collect loads of bits of work. They have their own. Every classroom has like a working wall of writing because we really want to promote children writing for all kinds of reasons and all kinds of purposes. So they've across nursery reception year one and year two, everyone's got a square on the board. And anytime they do any independent writing or writing with an adult, that can get pinned up over the week. So we can celebrate it all. We can promote it as being something that's really important. And then that changes each week. So yeah, so and that's our day. And then it will end with singing stories, you know, looking at some of the learning the children have done really well. You know, that's it. Yeah. So we don't really try to stop too much.
Yeah, no. And I really like that phrase, that contact with the curriculum, because often when you engage with schools that are looking at provision beyond early years, there was a worry about getting the curriculum done. And we often talk about that curriculum coverage doesn't necessarily mean curriculum learning. And actually, absolutely your not. Phrase there, contact with curriculum, I think is really strong, because the provision should connect to the curriculum and should connect to the teaching that's taking place. So therefore, and it's not about kind of having lots and lots and lots of enhancements and changing all the learning resources all of the time, but it's about that connection there. And that makes a real difference. And staff need to really understand that. The teachers, the support staff need to really kind of understand that. And the children need to understand the expectation there, that they are learning in the provision. And I think the fact that, again, you've obviously had some really deep conversations about documenting learning, and that is a conversation that needs to be had across the leaders about what we do need to document and why, and how that's impacting on learning, how we use it, why we're doing it, what's the purpose of it. And you know, you've almost removed lots of barriers. So there isn't the stop start for playtime. Interesting what you said about assemblies. There isn't the need to kind of to pull adults away from children in the provisions because they've got to go to a table to do some work, stick in a book and several books. Actually, you know, you've looked at removing those barriers. You've looked at the timetabling, and I would imagine actually you would have looked at how much the adults can be deployed into the provision, because that is where the children are continuing the learning process. They're consolidating and embedding that learning and taking it into the long-term memory. And if adults aren't in that space to engage, support, follow learning, can help the children to connect ideas, and are not there to see that taking place.
Yeah.
And it's chicken and egg then, because the more you're there, the more you understand what the children know, the more you can craft the teaching and learning absolutely. Opportunities to shape that and drive that forward. And the more it helps you to not need as much evidence, because you have that profound knowledge of the children because you spend so much time with them.
It starts to snowball,
doesn't it, in a good way?
It does. And I think we hear that at Pupil Progress. It's interesting because when you spend so much time engaging in the active cycle of and process of learning, it like in action, you get to know the needs of the children way more in detail than you would from a product.
Yeah, absolutely.
And who's the product for anyway? All we need to know is what do these children understand? What can they do, and what do they need to learn next? You know, and we can figure that out in loads of ways. The rest is just a vehicle for that learning. And there's many, many vehicles for learning. They don't all have to do the same thing all of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. And just going back to one of the things you mentioned, I think the reason that resourcing an environment is so important, because a lot of it has to be done before you actually get into the activity of the day, of the space, yes, of the timetable. Yeah. You've already, the fact that we have progressive block play across our nursery and key stage one, early years, that's progressive. The way the children's pegs are written is progressive. The way the children register in the morning is progressive. The way they place their water bottles in a TENS frame in year two is progressive. There's a lot of deliberate action that's happened across the environments where adults, TAs, teachers have literally gone around each other's classrooms and spaces to see what that looks like across the board so that it's built in.
Yeah. So what you're talking about there is actually the delivery and reinforcement of the curriculum through structures and routines of the day, not just through discrete teaching and through continuous provision. It's seeing that every opportunity is learning opportunities. And just listening to you, I think what kind of becomes quite clear there is you are talking about nursery reception year one, year two, as almost an entity. Mm-hmm. So because you wouldn't think twice about looking at nursery and reception now in the early years. So you'd probably more naturally, and I know this happens in schools, look at the progression, as you've mm-hmm. talked about, in terms of labelling or in block play or the continuity and progression, the small world resources. But actually you've done that almost as a phase that includes year one and year two, just because there is this term of early years and key stage one. Mm-hmm. Actually, what you're talking about, it sounds like, is actually they are one community and you're working that through. Like, and I think that mindset is quite a powerful place to get to. And then it helps to oil the wheels when you're having those discussions about continuity and progression.
I can't think of it any other way. And I think it's funny. And I think some of that's because, you know, Charlotte, who runs our early years, was a year three teacher who then went to year two and year one over the years and now leads nursery and therefore, or preschool, as we now call it, then reception. So she's phase group leader for reception and preschool. And our key stage one lead, Karina, who also is heavily involved in early excellence, she leads year one and two, but has got experience of teaching in key stage two as well, but great knowledge of year one too. So the fact that that Charlotte, as assistant head who leads a phase, or you know, that knowledge of working across all of those different year groups and seeing the relationship, seeing the connection, understanding the end game or end points for each of those discrete years, means that when we pull it all together as, like you say, a community, it's like half our school. It's much easier to then say, okay, well, this is going to be the child's journey through. Yeah. And then when they get to year three, our model of teaching and learning looks much more traditional in year three all the way up to year six, because of the research and evidence base we know about teaching and learning when they get older. So, you know, we've deliberately shaped our school based on that evidence and that information. Mm. And I think that's what's really important.
Yeah, and I think sometimes we get asked, are you not just moving that cliff face that I talked about potentially at the end of year one, or maybe the end of reception to year one or year one into year two? Aren't you just moving that to the end of year two into year three? And the answer to that is no, because of what you've just said in terms of how the children are developing as learners, particularly around that brain development. But equally, they are often more well prepared because of the rich experiences from nursery through to year two with that provision. They're more well rounded. They've got those thinking skills. They've got those learning behaviours. They've got those interests. And what you said earlier, that thirst for learning and that love of learning. And then they're kind of as well placed as they can be, as well as being developmentally and neurologically ready to approach learning in a different way.
Exactly that. I mean, we have thought a long and hard about year two, which is kind of a hybrid. We introduce, because children finish Read, Write, Ink in year two, we introduce our key stage two model for writing, mm-hmm. which is the right stuff, we introduce that in year two. So year two is a really hard year because they have a hybrid of the Key Stage 1 continuous provision model for as long as possible, all the way through the autumn and spring. And then during the summer, we start to think about what transition is going to look like into year three. But essentially, as I've said before, because teaching and learning across phases, across sectors, isn't really that different, not really, not how children learn, you know, in terms of memory, retrieval, practice, you know, all those principles. It's just the way that it looks. And that's the shift. Yeah. But at the moment, we're playing around with outdoor provision for year two, just because geographically our spaces, it's a bit harder for us to implement that in the same way. So that's one of our things we're working on. And also that then they're not having break either for the spring term and the first part of the summer term. So that's been our extension. Is taking some of those timetabling things off of year two so that we can have more continuous provision.
What you're still talking about is the evolution of things and how things move forward, and not saying in any of the year groups, this is what we're doing, this is how it's going to be for the year. That's not how teaching and learning works. So actually you're talking about that evolution. So let's talk about your children then in a little bit then. So you've been doing this for quite a while now, but what would you say? So what's the impact for children? Because if it wasn't working as a leader, you'd be kind of raising questions. Yeah. Actually, what you are saying is we're flying the flagship and it absolutely is working. So what is the impact of all of this? I think particularly for year one and year twos, because often there are worries about, will it impact on phonic outcomes? Will it impact on end of year two expectations? Will they be ready for year three? So what does it mean for your children?
It's always the numbers, isn't it, that everyone's interested in? Well, actually, we do really well for our disadvantaged here. So Lingfield is made up of, our context is we serve like a real mix of communities. We're not all one thing, which I think lots of schools might be. So we hover around the national for pupil premium. We've got a lot of send here, which I'll talk about in a sec. But we serve the working professionals who are commuting to London. We serve the disadvantaged part of this location, and we also serve skilled manual workforce. You know, we're kind of thirds, but we do really well for our disadvantaged pupils. In fact, in some cases those pupils do better than our non-disadvantaged children, and our phonics screening results generally hover around, you know, sort of 90%+ already, which I know is where the government wants to get to. So we've been achieving that for a while, and we're really proud of that. And I think it's because we put a lot into oracy, and we put a lot into vocabulary and speech and language. So that ties in with the send. So we have our own bespoke provision here. That's a whole nother podcast, because we are the only school in...
We'll get that into the diary.
As far as we know, we're the only school in Surrey that have this type of provision, because it's only our children that attend. But within that, we have two speech and language therapists here on site. So that means we can really meet the needs of children who come in with lower than typical oracy and speech and language development, which, you know, we're all seeing is increasing exponentially along with vocabulary. We put a lot into that and into early talk boost and into just vocabulary development, which means, again, that children leave their reception class going into year one with really good progress in that strand. And also they go into year three, so finishing year two, reading well, talking well. So we're above national for all of those outcomes at the end of year two. And I think that the focus is because going right back to the beginning of the podcast, we do less better. We pick interventions and programs that have got a fantastic research base to them. We trial things first. We train people how to do it properly. And we invest in time in execution of that. And each person running an intervention or supporting a particular group to make additional progress, that's the hat they wear. So they don't wear multiple hats. You know, people here have one job generally, and they do that one job really, really, really well. And I think because we've got that sort of specialist model, the outcomes as a result are really secure and solid and growing and improving. Because if you're trying to work on vocabulary, speech, talking, listening, then you need people who are really, really skilled at doing that alongside your teaching practitioners that are going to bring that into the provision. So it's a nice combination of specialists working alongside everyday practitioners, which I think makes us a bit special too, that we have that option.
Yeah. And of course, you've already kind of said your children move on to your children are developing and strengthening and growing and having that interest in learning, that love of learning, that kind of awe of wonder and kind of their attitudes, their behaviours. And those things aren't measurable in the same way as some of the other things that you've just talked about.
No.
But they're equally as important as things like RSE, aren't they? And it sounds like it's having a really positive impact and effect on that side of things as well. What you kind of call the softer things, but that we would be saying are so vitally important, the learning to learn, the learning to think sorts of things.
Yeah. But I think that comes in again back to leadership. So, you know, behavior is fundamental, isn't it? You know, children at any age aren't going to be thinking about the right things or remembering what we want them to remember if there's not an environment where that can take place. We have really strong principles for behavior here all the way through the school. And obviously, again, people working in primary schools will know that children are coming into school with, you know, more and more need, whether that's cognition and learning, speech and language, or SEMH. We're dealing with more and more of that as schools. And that starts when they're little. We get them when they're very young. And it's discerning what is developmental and what is send and what is because they need to be taught how to behave. And, you know, there's lots of evidence out there about behavior being a curriculum too. And children need to learn to be to behave as much as they learn need to learn to ride a bike and read. And the skill of the team here is to figure out cause and effect in that situation and then put in the right things in place to support that child, that family, but also to ensure inclusion. And as a highly inclusive school, that means inclusion for the other 29 as well as the child that might struggle, or the other 25 if you've got five children struggling. There's a lot involved in that, and in the send side or in the behavior side, again, there's other podcasts to be done, isn't there, on just looking at those strands individually, because they're pretty meaty things. But you know, our philosophy here is we let nothing get in the way of teaching and learning. We have a culture deck here, which we might have spoken about before. And there are principles that underpin everything we do at Lingfield. And one of those principles is, we let nothing get in the way of teaching and learning. And that's my job. My job is to make sure that my team, as in the leadership team, ensure that teachers can teach and children can learn. Yeah. And anything that gets in the way of that, we deal with.
Absolutely. And some of that can be, you know, the changing context of what's happening in the world and the children that you're receiving. But some of that can also be, as we said earlier, the white noise that's kind of coming through. The education arena is always challenging. There's always things happening. There's lots and lots, isn't there? And actually, it's going back to, what do our children need? How are we going to do that? How are we going to best support them? Okay, so kind of continuous revision as a pedagogical approach is something that you're kind of really passionate about. So kind of people who are listening, perhaps who are already doing continuous revision in Key Stage 1, or and it's maybe having some success, or it might be a little bit wobbly, or for leaders who are thinking about it, have you got any kind of top tips, things that have helped you either in terms of professional development for yourself as a leader, or for leaders who perhaps don't know as much about the phase or the approach, things around CPD for the wider team, things that have worked well for you in terms of implementation? I would imagine discussions and kind of reflection times are important, but what would your top tips be?
Wow, there's lots, isn't there? I think the reality is that this way of working, you know, the evidence base behind it, but it takes time. It cannot just be thrown into the mix because somebody thinks it's a good idea, because somebody's watched something, listened to something, been to see a school and been like, I want to do that. We've had so many visitors here over the years, often without their leadership team. And I think that's the problem, is that lots of amazing teachers come here and leave like going, oh, I really want to do that. But I have to go to assembly, or, you know, my children have French every Wednesday morning, or, you know, my head teacher doesn't get it, or whatever it is. And I really feel for those people, because in that situation, you know, it's really difficult to know where to start. So I think if I'm speaking to teachers, then I think they need to, you know, encourage their senior leaders to come along with them to come and see things in action and to ask questions about how you lead something like that. But yeah, the reality is it takes time. I would suggest that people find their superstars, you know, find those people that love it and are passionate about it and are committed to understanding what works and what doesn't. I would say That absolutely people need to understand how children learn from all perspectives, you know, like we've discussed now. You know, the people going into this, you know, there'll be things that they absolutely already know about what makes great teaching and learning. That doesn't change. All we're doing is we're just offering it in a different way. Most of the issues that I think people come across is giving up control, I think, as teachers. Am I allowed to say that? I think we like being in control.
I think it's about that familiarity and that kind of confidence, isn't it? And running continuous provision, taking that step is a big one. And it's a long journey. It's hard to get right from the kickoff. So actually, when staff start to engage in that, if it is wobbly, which it's likely to be honest, to start with, then there is that pull of, well, I'll go back to what was working previously. Yeah.
My question would be, was it working? My question would be, was it working previously? Yeah. Because there's a lot of poor proxies for learning out there. You know, just because a child is quiet and compliant does not mean they're learning. Mm-hmm. Just because a child produces a piece of paper does not mean they've learned anything either. So I think there's a lot of, but it does make an adult feel more comfortable. It does make an adult feel more confident that they've done their job if they can show some, like prove something.
Yeah.
And I think, so a lot of the work, I think, is undoing those misconceptions around what learning actually looks like and how do we know that learning has happened? Mm-hmm. You know,
from a leader's point of view, you're right in terms of we talk a lot about kind of encouraging leaders to be engaged in the process and actually to build their own knowledge and understanding. And we, you know, we've got courses for early years and Key Stage 1 and SEND and 2-year-old provision that's targeted specifically for school leaders for that kind of very reason. You know, if you think for EYS for the moment and dare I say kind of the inspection toolkit, there is an expectation for heads to understand early years. If you're striving for that strong standard, it specifically talks about head teachers' knowledge and leadership and such like, not just leaders. But actually, you would be applying that to all aspects and leaders' understanding. And actually, leaders, that question you just posed for, is it working? Leaders need to be engaging with the children, having conversations that they can, so the children can showcase what they know and can retrieve and can explore and can articulate and can think about and can problem solve. Books don't show that. Watching a carpet session doesn't show that. So the thinking for teachers may support to change that mindset of this feels safe and I've done my job. Equally, I think there's a lot to kind of explore around leadership and leaders' thinking and how they see learning as well and how they build their knowledge and understanding and confidence of the learning that's taken place if it's not in a book or at a carpet time.
Yeah. And that's why I think you've got to do less better, because if you take that philosophy, then you have some very key identified and agreed programs that you're going to do to provide instruction, and then you're going to go into the environment and you're going to go and see and look and listen and provide opportunities to know whether that learning has actually landed. And then you've got the national curriculum, we've got Development Matters, so you know everything has to be really tightly linked. You know, what resources you're using have to earn their place. Where you're going to deploy your adults that day need to have been thought about. But at the end of the day, we do have really clear knowledge of what the children are supposed to know by the end of a year group. Mm-hmm. And we always have to come back to that to help us if we feel like we're going off on a tangent or if things are becoming a bit woolly, because that means we've lost sight of the end goal. And if we keep the end goal at the centre all of the time, then we should actually stay on track. But it's that reassurance that, you know, if children have got to be able to learn to write numbers 1 to 10, as an example, it doesn't matter how they learn that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the leap. The leap is we can easily all look up an objective and that's black and white and makes us feel safe. The fact that you could have 30 children showing you that in slightly different ways is the bit that worries people. Yeah. So then that's about your own agreed ways you're going to, you know, document that or acknowledge how that's happened. And that can be done in lots and lots of ways. But yes, busy work and busy classrooms and quiet children does not equal learning. And it's getting under the skin of that.
And I think really reflecting on what's the best way to present this piece of learning. So that key knowledge, the foundational knowledge or the key things for the end of the academic year that we, you know, we're saying that children need to get to, what's the best way to present that learning? And do you know what, for phonics, the phonics schemes, whichever scheme you're using, overall, that's the best way to present that learning.
Absolutely.
But it shouldn't be in isolation. The children should be applying those skills outside of the phonic lesson. But for other things, it really is about stepping back and thinking, is this the best way to present this learning? Or if I'm asking that things have got to go as a leader, if I'm asking for things to be documented in books, is that becoming a barrier to the best way to present learning? Yeah. Or is it, are we losing time because we've presented it practically and then had to do it in the books?
You're so right. And I think that's about honest relationships and the culture you set within your teams. I know that, you know, my team will come to me and say, Cass, this isn't working, or floor books are taking too long. And we're like, right, okay. And then Charlotte and Karina will discuss with their phases what we can do to lift some of that. Because the best bit about floor books was the documentation of the children's learning journey and their contributions. The fact that things looked nice, the teachers quite liked, but it was burdensome time-wise. And actually, it's me giving them permission to say, because often teachers need permission, don't they? Not because I feel like I have to, but more like going, actually, they might look lovely, they can look slightly less lovely and free up loads of your time to prepare your environment for the next day, which is way more impactful on teaching and learning than having something that just looks beautiful, which, you know, I can give permission. What I can't do is change people's habits. That's tricky. It's very difficult to change teachers' habits. And luckily, you know, I'm in a school where I've been here nearly 20 years. I've employed pretty much everyone in the building. And therefore, they have, you know, they're part of the Lingfield culture. And, you know, they've been recruited for a reason. So, you know, it comes down to your school culture. You know, it's really, really important that teachers are able to reflect and say, I'm not really sure why I'm doing this. Who's it for?
Yeah.
I know my children. I can talk about what they can do. I don't need this bit of paper here. I don't need a book for, you know, history or a book for music or a book for RE. I just don't need it. That's just it's a very traditional view that doesn't fit into early years or Key Stage 1 anymore, I don't believe.
And I think floor books are interesting, aren't they? Because you've hit the nail on the head in terms of that it's not about them looking beautiful. And it's not just about it showing curriculum in action. It needs to be a teaching and learning tool. From my point of view as an external visitor, whenever I go to schools that have got floor books, I open them and the children will come and tell me. And it tells me, it's so insightful. Yeah. It tells me about their confidence to speak to a visitor. It tells me about the language and communication skills that they've got. It tells me what learning experiences they can remember. It tells me what knowledge they can retrieve, what vocabulary is there. It's so, so powerful, more powerful than looking at something in isolation.
Absolutely. They're really rich resources and the kids love them.
Yeah, but I think that is key. That saying they don't need to look beautiful. We have, it's the setting the parameters, isn't it? We expect X, Y, and Z, as in every child is reflected at some point within it, or we capture the children's voice, or that you do and allow the children to access it and talk about it. We don't need it to be A, B, and C. It might be that you say we want the vocabulary in there, for example, or key objective. It may not be that, but it's about setting the parameters, and looking beautiful isn't necessarily one of them.
And that's exactly what we did. I mean, our phase group leaders met last week and they went through them and did exactly what you've just said. You know, we are linking learning objectives to things because we want the rigor to always return to the point of what we're doing. Words, words, words are one of our SDPs for this year. So the vocabulary is really high profile. We're using the Noun Project to support with that, which is a brilliant resource if people haven't heard of it. But one thing I haven't mentioned earlier, which I think is really important, is years and years ago, when I was very new to teaching, I did the Effective Early Learning Program with Christine Pascal and Tony Bertram, which is very old now, very, very old, but still is so great. And if anyone can ever get their hands on it, it still is online, I think. I think it is. I'm showing my age, aren't I?
I'm saying nothing.
But I will always advise Charlotte and Karina to go back to those things, because you can look at involvement levels of children. And it's such a key resource for really understanding the environment and the dynamics at play when you walk into an excellent early years or Key Stage 1 classroom. And if you can notice some of those things, I think it's pivotal, a bit like a trip to Reggio, to really sussing out what you want your practice to look like. And I think it's a great starting point for anyone embarking on this type of work, is to really, really look at the nuts and bolts of what really good learning how really good learning happens before you even think about how, you know, what furniture you're going to buy. I mean, that's the cherry on the top, right? But that is not going to work if you haven't done this bit of groundwork first in terms of the theory and the practice. That's so important.
Yeah. The groundwork, the research, the kind of exploring, discussing, reading a bit more, visiting, finding out, yeah, really so reflecting, that is the biggest part of it. And that almost all needs to happen before you kind of jump into it. And I know there are some schools and settings that don't, they jump straight in, but it's about kind of having that deep knowledge and understanding.
Yeah, wow. Start small.
Yeah.
Would be the top tip. Don't try and roll it out across 3 or 4 year groups or classes, or just start small and grow it.
Yeah. And that is that continual reflection and discussion as well, isn't it? Which is important for any kind of school improvement. I mean, the session has absolutely flown by. I can't believe we're up to time already, although I have made a note of a couple of other podcasts that we might come back together and do. But yeah, I just really wanted to kind of say thank you so much. You talk so eloquently, and you obviously have got a real deep and rich understanding in terms of what you're doing. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, people do come and visit your school, and I think that's kind of open to people, you know, if you'd like to. Of course, you are strongly encouraging leaders. And I know when we connect schools together, we kind of say the same thing. So if your head can come along as well, because it's about kind of, and it's not about seeing what Lingfield are doing and saying, right, that's what we're doing, pick it up and plonk it in our school. Actually, it's part of that research that we were just talking about.
Yeah. And we're not the finished article, you know, we're not finished. But curriculum development with whatever phase is never finished. It's never done. This is where we are now. We've got Opal starting this year. So that's an excellent next step for us to be thinking about lunch times. And yeah, we've got some tweaks in year two that we're making. And like you said about the Ofsted framework, we're in the window for Ofsted actually. So we're due to be inspected, I think, in the summer, certainly after Easter, potentially be September, but I think it'll be this year. Our next step is to get all of our subject leads fully key stage one knowledgeable, because it's great that half the school are, but I need the whole school to be. You know, there is always, I hope that's reassuring for people, is that, you know, whatever stage you're at in this process, there's always something else to do, there's always something new to think about, and that's the joy of being a head teacher, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about making the difference in for your children and your school, but then it's more widely, isn't it? It's about that impact on education and supporting kind of that wider network. So great. And last thing I just wanted to touch on before we finish, we mentioned it near the start, and you said, of course, for the school as well, you're doing blogs and such like, but I know that quite recently, although it's a little while since we started, so it's maybe not as recent, but you released your blog that kind of talked about provision and pedagogical approaches and those sorts of things. So do you want to just for a moment shout about that before we finish?
Thank you. Yeah, so if anyone's interested in looking at blogs that come from Lingfield, you can follow us on Twitter, or X, as I should be calling it now, under the Educakers. That's because Anna and I eat lots of cake, as well as talk lots of things, education. And you will find blogs there all to do with teaching and learning across the primary phase, also about leadership and culture. And yes, I have a blog on there called Purposeful Learning in Action. Yes, play, because play is important and there's lots of ways to view it. And so I wanted to share my knowledge and insights into what that looks like here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And of course, we're kind of signposting that, but listeners, I know, will already know we've got plenty of blogs and podcasts as well, freely available on our website. But obviously, you've joined as a guest, and I promised that we would share that. And I've had a look around and those sort of things. We spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, so it's about kind of sharing the links, but we'll try and drop the link into this podcast as well, so that people can access that. But thank you so much for your time. It's been great to chat, and it's just flown by.
It really has. Thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for joining us today. I hope you found it a valuable listen and that you've taken some things away to reflect on, or maybe things that you want to discuss with your colleagues. Of course, remember, if you want to talk about any of the issues that we've explored today, or you need support with other matters in your school, then do feel free to drop me an email, sarah@earlyexcellence.com, or why not get connected with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. Anyway, take care and join me next time for some more genuine head-to-head conversation.